Happy Independence Day. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, July 4th, 2011. I'm Kyle Callums. In a few minutes, a stroll along some of the trails around Crystal Bridges, and Chase and Missy Gibson will return to the Furman Garner Performance Studio. They play tonight in Bentonville for the Bentonville 4th of July celebration. They'll be at Mount Sequoia tomorrow for the First Tuesday Music Series. But we'll begin this summer holiday edition of Ozarks with Bugs. Amy Stewart is the author of the book Wicked Plants, and now her latest nonfiction work is Wicked Bugs, the louse that conquered Napoleon's army and other diabolical insects. She explains she loves nature, just not necessarily the sunny side of things.
I really like the dark side. I think I'm really drawn to that. You know, anyone who reads murder mysteries will own up to the fact that they kind of like the dark side of the world. And Wicked Bugs was a follow-up to Wicked Plants. So, I started with the plants and was really thinking about how the fact that there is this dark side to the world of horticulture and botany, and there's a lot of poisons in the plant world, and there are murders that have been committed, and so on and so forth. And it was not much of a leap to get from there to bugs.
Well, I think anyone who's ever had a spider web around their house and paid attention to it over a few days realizes that the insect world can be very dark.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, spiders, and I should say for all the entomologists out there,
yes,
that I had to use the term bugs. I need a simple term for creepy crawly critters, but of course there are spiders and there are worms and there are other things that are not properly called bugs or insects. But yeah, spiders, I mean, I have this tendency to want to leave a spider web in my house so I can watch what's going on. One year I had this giant European cross spider in my kitchen window, and I was fascinated with it, and I called my local entomologist friend and told him about it, and he said, well, that's great, but what you need to know is that it's October, which means that she's pregnant, and at any point she's going to be giving birth to about 200 little babies, and you might not want all of them in your kitchen. I said, okay, I'm putting her outside.
You, of course, as you might expect, there are chapters here devoted to the black widow and the brown recluse, but I want to start with what I think is the scourge of the universe, and that is the chigger.
Yes. Well, interesting that that's the one you go right to. I take it you've had some run-ins with it.
I have, and they have been epic, and they have been horrible.
Yes, the chigger mite. Well, a terrible creature. Now, does not transmit a lot of disease here in the United States. It's very annoying, though, and it's a terrible, terrible bite. But, you know, for instance, in Southeast Asia, when our troops were there in, fighting in the Pacific Theater, you know, World War II, they really became infected with terrible diseases as a result of the chigger mite. Scrub typhus is a nasty disease that really made life miserable for our soldiers and kept them in the hospital a lot longer than things like malaria did.
And the chigger, I think there's been a misconception for some time that the chigger burrows in and that's what you're scratching. But the annoyance that's left, that irritation, is after the mite has already jumped off your body, right?
Yeah, they do leave their little feeding tube behind.
Ugh.
So that's something that if you look closely, you might see it like a tiny little, almost like a splinter. But yeah, part of what's so awful about that bite is actually that it's not a very good biter as opposed to, say, a mosquito. A chigger mite can't really get at you very well, and so they just sort of bite in without looking around for a blood vessel. And so that's why it ends up being such a messy and awful and irritating bite.
You mentioned that when you wrote your book, Wicked Plants, you talked about poisons. Poisons enter into wicked bugs as well, and there's evidence through history that people have used ground up poisonous bugs to put on tips of spears.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, arrow poisons. And, you know, this is really fascinating. It is surprisingly hard to find much out about arrow poisons because they really are the secret formula of one tribe or another. So there have been lots of attempts to guess at what goes on them or to try to observe these rituals of making poison arrow tips. But, yeah, they can involve everything from scorpions to venomous spiders, and then usually even a little bit of rattlesnake venom thrown in for good measure. So really just whatever is available in the natural world that seems toxic. A lot of poisonous plants got used for arrow poisons as well.
And bugs and insects have been used in warfare for as long as we've been creating war.
Yeah. Yeah, I was really surprised by that. You know, you think of the Greeks and the Romans, and a lot of people have heard of this, that they would sort of make their own beehives, maybe out of straw, and fill it with, you know, angry swarming bees or hornets, and catapult it over the enemy's walls. So it's this very Monty Python-esque idea, right, of pulling up a catapult and tossing bees at the enemy. But this has gone on even in the 20th century. The Japanese, during World War II, worked on a program to drop plague-infested fleas into California. And they were ready to do it. They had these clay bombs they'd built, and the fleas would survive impact and could spread the plague. They even tested it in China, and there were little outbreaks of the plague in China. So they were ready to go with that. Now, even today, the Department of Defense has developed this program, or they're working on a program, to implant a computer chip inside a caterpillar, in the hopes that the caterpillar will turn into a butterfly and that the Department of Defense will be able to remotely control the butterfly's flight path and send it into enemy territory to do surveillance, if you can imagine.
You know, it sounds crazy, but who
sounds
knows?
Sounds crazy, but it just might work. They thought of crazier things. The same department that's working on this is the one that essentially came up with the Internet. So you never know what they're going to think of next.
I'm talking with Amy Stewart. Her latest book is titled Wicked Bugs. It's about just that. Until I had read this book, I had never heard of the Schmidt Sting Pain Index. But I'm so happy it exists.
It's a wonderful thing. This is Justin Schmidt, and he's an amazing guy, by the way. He's an entomologist who has studied all manner of stinging insects, bees and ants in particular he is fascinated with. And he realized early on in his research that no one had ever scientifically quantified the pain from various types of stings. And originally, he started out just doing a numerical scale. But once some natural history and science magazines got a hold of his research, it became necessary to make the scale a little more interesting. So now every bee and ant is described kind of in the way that you would describe wine, like the sweat bee, which hardly hurts at all, is called light and ephemeral and almost fruity. And then there's like the tarantula hawk, which described as like a running hairdryer being dropped into your bubble bath. So it's a very vivid and entertaining pain index.
And there's something called the bullet ant that's at the top of this pain index.
Yes, it's a 1-4 scale, and this one is off the charts. It's sort of a 4+. And it's described as being like fire walking over flaming charcoal with a 3-inch rusty nail in your heel. Most of us don't even want to imagine what that is like, but nonetheless.
No, and when you see that a fire ant only rates a 1.2, I can't imagine then the 4.0+ of the bullet ant.
I mean, that's one thing, is it kind of puts our own pests in perspective. And that's really true throughout the book, that I really gained a very healthy perspective about how relatively little we are plagued by insects as compared to other parts of the world.
The insects that you write about in Wicked Bugs, the bugs and the other animals that you write about, you give them each a different sort of honor. Some are called dangerous, some are called destructive, some are called horrible.
Horrible.
I would assume, to me, that seems like the most frightening tag that you can give.
Well, horrible usually means that they're gross, but that they're not really going to inflict any long-lasting damage on us. But, you know, for instance, I put maggots in the horrible category, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't really hurt us that much. I mean, it sounds awful to have the larva of a fly want to burrow under your skin. But, in fact, you're probably going to survive it. And weirdly, a lot of creatures like that, these little fly larvae that we call maggots, if they do burrow under the skin, they actually excrete some very healthy little enzymes and some antibiotics to keep the wound clean so that they can stay in there and survive and do what they want to do. So, in fact, you might not even get any kind of infection, but it is nonetheless horrible.
Well, one group of people that kind of likes maggots and the animals that you call the corpse eaters, that collection, are coroners because or investigators, because it can help solve a crime.
Oh, yeah. Well, forensic entomology is, you know, a fascinating field, and it can help solve a crime afterwards. So, for instance, there was a very interesting case, a woman who died, and there were different bugs, let's say, you know, living on her remains, and normally you can look at the age of them and you can tell how long she's been dead. Well, they had these creatures, these larvae, at different stages of their life, and it made it very confusing. They couldn't figure out the time of death, which made it harder to solve the case. And a forensic entomologist was able to figure out that she had done cocaine right before she died, and that the larvae that were near her face where the cocaine were grew at a faster rate and appeared to be older than they really were. And that proved to be a really pivotal point in solving the case.
I'm talking with Amy Stewart. She's written the book Wicked Bugs. Boy, there's so many that we could talk about. The stink bug that brings, if not fear, but brings a sigh to people who live in certain parts of the country when autumn arrives, because they can just burrow into your house and, I guess, emit a rather unpleasant odor?
Yeah, I mean, and we're talking here particularly about the brown marmorated stink bug, which is an Asian invader. And this is not just a few little bugs coming in the house. This can be hundreds and hundreds of stink bugs coming in the house, climbing up the Christmas tree and taking their place among the Christmas ornaments. You open the drawer to get out a spoon or a fork in the morning, and they're in there. I mean, they're really everywhere. So they're a pretty awful pest just in terms of having them around the house. They're not necessarily going to stink unless you attempt to vacuum them up, which is what people do, and then that releases the terrible odor. And they are starting to eat some crops, so they're going to get to be a bigger and bigger agricultural pest, I think, as time goes on.
Don't get me wrong. I love the text in this book. It's the words are great, and what I learn is fantastic, but there is artwork involved in Wicked Bugs that is just stunning.
Yeah, the art is pretty amazing. This is a young woman named Bryony Morrow Cribbs. She was 25 when she started on Wicked Plants. I think she's about 30 now, but young, still in school. And what she has done are copper plate etchings. So when you look at these illustrations, you have to see that every little line and every dot is done by hand on a plate of copper. She wears a jeweler's mask when she works because it's such a fine level of detail. And then she inks the plate and makes a print, very much the way books were illustrated 200 or 300 years ago. I mean, there is nothing digital involved in the making of this art. It's a very old craft, and she's done an extraordinary job.
It's hard to imagine a better-looking worm or African hornet or whatever. I mean, these are just gorgeous.
Yeah, she manages to be very accurate but also make them seem kind of creepy, which was, of course, what we needed.
So are you the type of person that has no problem picking up a bug and looking at it and inspecting it?
Yeah, that's true. I'm pretty fearless when it comes to bugs. I want to get right down on the floor and have a look at them. And if there's a bug in the house, I'm the one who will go and get it and put it outside. And, you know, one of the things I learned in the process of writing this book is that, for the most part, bugs do not want to hurt us. They're unwilling to sting. They really want to be left alone. And most of them are physically incapable of harming us. And this is particularly true with spiders. You know, a lot of the spiders that you see around your house and garden couldn't hurt you if they wanted to. They can't break your skin. They can't do anything. So, I'm a big bug lover. I have, though, come to realize that a little healthy fear can be a good thing.
Oh.
You know, I mean, I managed to round up 100 or so bugs that are murderous or deadly or dangerous, and it's kind of like the fear that keeps you from walking across the freeway at rush hour. That's a good thing. So I have learned to keep a wide berth from some. And I think it's particularly important for people traveling. You know, maybe you go on a tropical vacation, you go to Thailand or somewhere. You have to remember that there are a lot of creatures there that we are just not used to seeing and dealing with here at home. And I do have a lot of stories about unsuspecting tourists who got themselves in a little bit of trouble with a wicked bug.
Yes, you do. We have to talk about the emerald cockroach wasp. This is a fascinating creature.
It is fascinating, and, you know, I tried to steer away from just bugs that eat other bugs, because that's not very wicked. That's just what they're supposed to do. That's how nature was meant to work. But there are certain bugs that will actually inhabit the body of other bugs, and so I called them zombies. I could not resist having a chapter on zombies. And the emerald cockroach wasp is actually able to sting the cockroach's brain in this very particular place that disables its desire to fight or flee or run away, which by itself is amazing. Like, who knew the cockroach had more than one part
exactly.
to its brain, right? And once she does that, she can lead it around like a dog on a leash. She can just grab it by its antenna and say, come over here with me. And she lays it down, and she lays her eggs on it, and then she takes off. She's done with motherhood at that point. She's like, you watch the kids. I'm out of here. And the cockroach just lays there and lets the eggs hatch, and the little larvae eat away at the cockroach, and it allows that to happen. And, of course, eventually it dies, and its body becomes a cocoon for all these little baby wasps who will eventually grow up and go off and find other cockroaches to do that to.
If when the second printing of this book or when it comes out in paperback, the blurb that should be on here is read to the end and you will feel sorry for a cockroach. That was the takeaway for me. I just felt so sorry reading about it, the cockroach there.
I know. Who knew we could ever have sympathy for a cockroach?
The name of the book is Wicked Bugs, the Louse that Conquered Napoleon's Army and Other Diabolical Insects. Amy, you've done plants. You've done insects. Are you thinking of continuing?
You know, somebody just last night told me I should do wicked rodents next.
Ooh, okay.
I know. Yeah, I don't know if I'm going to go there or not. We'll see. We'll see.
That might test your fearless model there.
I know it might.
Amy, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Amy Stewart is the author of the book Wicked Bugs, The Louse That Conquered Napoleon's Army and Other Diabolical Insects. You can learn more online at wickedbugs.com.
Earth, sky.
Monday, July 4th. Today, our planet Earth reaches its most distant point from the Sun for all of 2011.
Astronomers call this farthest point Earth's aphelion. Today, we're about 5 million kilometers, or 3 million miles, farther from the Sun than we will be 6 months from now. That's in contrast to our average distance from the Sun of about 150 million kilometers, or 93 million miles.
We're always farthest from the Sun in July, during Northern Hemisphere summer. We're always closest in January, in Northern winter. So you can see that Earth's distance from the Sun doesn't create the seasons. Seasons on Earth result from our world's tilt on its axis. Right now, the northern part of Earth is tilted most toward the Sun, and the southern part is tilted most away.
At our farthest point from the Sun, like now, Earth is traveling most slowly in its orbit. That makes summer the longest season in the northern hemisphere, and winter the longest season on the southern half of the globe.
Conversely, winter is shortest in the north and summer shortest in the south, in each instance by nearly 5 days.
So, happy aphelion, everyone, and enjoy this Independence Day of sorts for Earth, now at its farthest from the Sun for this year. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
This is a July 4th, 2011 edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Hopefully, you've been able to get some rain during this holiday weekend that helps your gardens. Surrounding the new Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art will be a hybrid landscape of lush meadows, heirloom gardens, a spring-fed lake, trails, and old-growth forest. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich on this holiday takes us to meet the landscape architect.
A shady path northeast of Compton Gardens leads to a locked trail gate to the south grounds of Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. Scott Eccleston, the museum's director of trails and grounds and a landscape architect, takes us through the locked gate. He and his staff have been working 10 hours a day to finish landscape construction and installation before the museum's grand opening in mid-November. 50% of the job is complete, Eccleston said. But when he first arrived on site, he encountered landscaper's block.
And as I was walking through the woods, there was no trails, I started seeing all the colors and the sounds and all the textures and the shapes and all the different plants. So I kept telling myself early on there was nothing to work with, and I was absolutely wrong. Everything was in place.
Meaning the native landscape would serve as his template. It's pest resistant and will thrive in composted soil amended beds brought on site. But the native plant material he's chosen, especially trees, cannot be found at local nurseries.
We traveled across the southern part of the United States, and we would look for these hickories and these hop hornbeams, and we would find these farmers that said, you know what, my dad decided to get in the nursery business, the tree growing business, about 50 years ago, and we couldn't sell these trees. And he said, you have asked for a tree that my father has grown. And the grass would be 8 foot tall, and they would bushwhack to these groves of these trees, and there they were. And he said, you know, my father felt someday somebody would want these trees, and now these trees are coming to Crystal Bridges.
And these are not heirloom trees, shrubs, and perennials, but special cultivars.
For instance, everybody is accustomed to the redbud. Well, now we are going to use redbuds. One in particular is called Hearts of Gold. Has a gold leaf, okay? We have one called Appalachia. When the flowers come out, you've seen the typical light purple flowers of the redbud. These are the most fluorescent red that you have ever seen. And then we go into the dogwoods. Typical dogwood blooms about 2.5 weeks. We are using different cultivars of these parent plants, or what we call nativars, that started blooming and actually bloomed for 55 days. We had a different dogwood blooming.
Purchased trees and plants are stored in the Crystal Bridges Museum nursery until installed. And this trail's already mass planted with drifts of flowering echinacea, milkweed, and ferns. Museum grounds, which will include a spring-fed lake, will also have lots of outdoor seating and grassy areas. The lake will be recharged by Crystal Spring, which is currently being diverted beneath the construction zone. It flows through Town Branch Creek along this trail, and Eccleston has created a natural water park with a stone stairway access. Children can even play here. The original water course was a muddy 4-foot-wide stream bed, but when he removed the debris, he found beautiful eroded white limestone beds and pools.
And you see the limestone has been cut by thousands of years of this spring trickling through and then falling off, going underneath this bridge. And to me, this is an area of meditation. It's an area that I can see prom pictures and photos, but it's one of those jewels that we talk about. You know, if you go to the museum, but you don't go to the trails, really your destination is incomplete, because we have these places that is really like artwork here tucked away.
This trail segment is just a small piece of a much larger complex trail system.
Through our site is about a mile-long concrete trail, but it is much bigger. It's a part that leads all the way to Bella Vista. It will be soon connected to the Razorback Greenway. You can go from Rogers to Fayetteville. It comes right through Crystal Bridges. And I think that is just exciting, that people can just get on that trail, come from Fayetteville, pedal all the way here.
40-acre parcel of the original 120-acre undeveloped valley was originally owned by Dr. Neil Compton, the rest by the Walton family, Eccleston said.
And it is made up of two distinct forests. You know, trees have a lifespan, and we realize that. We have trees that are well over 200 years old. And we said, what can we do to keep this going? And so we started early on our second-generation tree program. And that basically is a program that which we start a whip or a small tree, and we have it planted in our nursery. And then we start to put those in places along the woods that, you know what, we realize that this sycamore that is 150 foot tall will not always be here. So what can we do to start thinking about generations beyond you and I? What will they see? And so we're starting to think about that and plant those trees.
So some areas will be left wild, so visitors can observe the evolution of Ozark's forests. Guides will lead patrons through the museum grounds to learn about what's planted. This trail temporarily terminates just above the museum's construction site. A bridge will be built here over the Crystal Spring stream bed.
We are a guest, and we are a steward of this incredible 120 acres. And being a steward is thinking about how a landscape goes through and what is the impact. It goes way back early on with Moshe Safdie and how he said the architecture and construction of the building is going to be one with the site. We will only disturb a 6-foot area behind the building, which is unheard of. And the piece of advice that he gave me early on, he said, Scott, he said, I want you to create these trails with such a small footprint. Second of all, I want the trails to be an exciting adventure where you give people glimpses of the museum and then you take them away. But then you feed them a spring or a seat or a special tree. And that has really been in the back of my mind the whole time when designing, is how can I create those excitement and give those peaks of interest. And the second thing is our founder, Miss Walton. She said, you know, the architecture is just going to be amazing, Scott. And she said, you know, the artwork is going to be first class. And the education department is going to teach everybody about the art and nature. She said, but finally, the grounds, Scott. She said, this is the land that we grew up on. This is where my brothers and sisters, you know, her brother and her had spent time. She said, so treat it very well. Treat it like your own. And a little bit of pressure, you know, because I wanted to exceed her expectations, but I wanted to delicately cut my way through the forest.
And as is Alice Walton's wish, lots of native forsythia will be planted on the grounds of the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in honor of her mom, Helen Walton. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
There will be no charge to hike the grounds of the Crystal Bridges Museum of American History. And the first segment of the art trail leading northeast out of Compton Gardens, providing an excellent view of the museum construction site, is now open. This is a July 4th edition of Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. The 4th of July holiday will be celebrated tonight in Bentonville as part of the city's Parks and Recreation Summer Concert Series at Orchards Park. At 7 o'clock tonight, Chase Missy will take the stage. Then about 8:15, the Arkansas Winds Community Band. And at about 9:30 tonight in Bentonville, fireworks. All of this open to the public, and it's all free. Recently, Chase and Missy Gibson of Chase Missy came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio at KUAF. Antoinette Grajeda and I talked to them about why they like being in Northwest Arkansas so much after traveling around the country. So you've been together in Atlanta, been together in New York City, now you're together in Fayetteville.
Right.
And you have a 2-year-old?
I have almost 3 and then an 8-month-old.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Does that change songwriting at all?
Well, just
the opportunity.
The opportunity to do it. I think it's the only thing it's done for me is the opportunity to do it, because, you know, you just, life gets in the way a little bit. So you really have to make an effort. And I think, you know, this is just as you grow up and get more responsibility. But I find myself having to really make an effort to write. Where before, writing came out of me not making an effort at all. You know, sitting around and just hanging out, or saw something that inspired me or whatever. And now I think you have to really make time to write, which, so it's born out of a different place for me. It's not necessarily just out of that kind of free creative space. It really is out of me sitting down and making time to do it.
And sometimes it's harder because you feel like you're trying to force like a song. So like on the way home, like driving home, I may get this idea in my head for this song, whereas used to, when as soon as you got home, you just went and got your guitar out of the closet and you just kind of figured out chords and everything else. Now, you know, by the time it's 9 o'clock and they're all in bed asleep, you're just like, oh, I can't remember what the melody was. I remember the words somewhat, but I can't remember what the, you know, how I was resolving the verse or something like that. So it definitely makes it tougher. It makes you, I some evenings walk around humming like the thing to myself over and over and over, like hundreds of times, in hopes that that I can remember it after they go to bed so I can try to figure it out. But.
Well, and it also, it does change your, I mean, it's changed my perspective on life, obviously. So it does add more material there. I mean, we have written songs about them. And, yeah. And with that experience, it's like being a parent. So that's kind of cool, too.
Yeah, like the song we just played, I probably wouldn't write right now. I mean, it was before kids, it was easier to write, you know, like a cheating song, that kind of thing, because it's just easier to go to, like, those kind of darker places and write that stuff.
Wow, whereas, where are we going with this?
Now when you sit
Excuse
down
me?
To... But it was easy to kind of transport yourself to, you know, sad things or darker things and that kind of stuff, because now when I write, I find myself, like, always like, oh, that's so cheery, like, you know, because you just, you know, it's just... With the kids and everything else, it's kind of...
Well, whatever you may be losing with songwriting with that, I think your personal life, that would be a plus.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm always thinking cheery thoughts, so that's
yeah.
not a...
And you're gaining a lot more, like, songwriting material. So the thing
yeah,
is...
Yeah, you really came off real twisted in that quote.
When the...
I just want to be the first person to tell you that.
But, yeah, I mean, I guess with the kids, though, you gain a lot of songwriting material now, too. Like, you know, two or three of our new songs are, like, about the kids, but, like, when you listen to it, you don't necessarily know it's really about the kids kind of thing. So we're trying to stay away from, you know, the sort of blatantly, like, you know, I have a baby and I'm going to sing, you know. And, I mean, I like a lot of songs on country radio, but there's some that, you know, I just kind of
find... mentioned sippy cups
yeah,
and
I kind
like
of find myself going, okay, that's a little too... So we're trying... It's trying to make a song actually more general, where used to maybe you're trying to make a song more specific by inserting characters and people and things and trying to make it a specific story, whereas now you're starting with a specific story, which is like your kids or your family, and you're trying to make it more general and try to take them out of it as much as you can and make it something that people can relate to. So
when you were talking about the scene in Atlanta, and there were a lot of people mm-hmm. writing songs in New York, of course, mm-hmm. did you ever hear someone and think, oh, wow, why am I even doing this? Because they're so good.
Are you kidding me?
All the time.
In Atlanta, like, it was every week. But you know what was interesting is those people that we met, number one, you become friends with so many people and you get this almost network of friends that are different, because it's almost like college where everybody's there for the same reason. And so everybody had this common denominator of struggling to do music. And so it really was interesting, you know, in theater, it's different because you become competitive and, you know, you're really trying to beat each other out for things. And then in Atlanta, what ended up happening was everybody was supporting each other and you were trying to hook everybody else up with gigs. And you're like, well, I know this guy really well and I can get you a gig here and yada, yada. So it became an interesting network of support as opposed to competition. But no, constantly we were being amazed by people. And we were also amazed that those people weren't getting gigs. You know, they would tell us all the time about how they weren't getting booked. And I've been trying to get in that place for 6 months, or I've been trying to get in that place for 2 years, or one guy, I've been trying to get in that place for 3 years. And I'm like, are they deaf? Because you're phenomenal, you know. But then you also are awakened to the world of what restaurants or clubs or venues are really looking for and what their bottom line is too. And so you become this business-minded person, like, well, they need something in that's going to, sell drinks and sell whatever and keep people around. And so, you know, we kind of got educated in a way of that too. So,
and I think the cool thing too about that scene was that, as you can tell by the two songs we played, we don't really fit into a genre. And so there were so many other people that were like us. You know, people are saying, well, you need to, you know, if it was like record type people, you need to hone your sound and you need to figure out, are you country or are you pop or are you... And so it was just cool because there were a lot of other people that were just like that. I mean, one song was real country, one was real folky, one was... and so it was just nice to be around those other people. They're like, hey, you know, we're just doing this and these are our songs and this is what we're coming up with. And if they're back to back on the CD and they sound nothing alike, it's cool. You know, you're doing your own CD independently and you're just getting your music out there. And that's the feedback that we heard from so many people when we put out our CD was, man, it's really cool because I don't get bored because none of the songs sound the same. You know, you can go from song to song. So it's kind of, I think it was Chris Robinson, maybe the Black Crowes, that said, you know, music's like, people think of it as like a piece of pie, but it's really like this circle that has an infinite number of points. So there's room for everybody because it's not like theater where there's five major roles and you're trying to beat somebody out for them. It's there's somebody that hates what we do, and then there's somebody who loves what we do. And so there's all those people out there, and there's room for everybody. So, and that's what was cool. Like, you get a gig, and you'd call up your friend and say, I'm going to talk to them and see if they'll let me have an opener. You guys want to get up and play for 20 minutes, like, before we play? And they do the same thing for you. And so it was just a really supportive scene, and very, very neat.
We definitely miss it. We talk about that, just how cool it was. There was just so many local singer-songwriters, and there's just this network of people, and it was very unique.
And you get in a unique metro area, 4 or 5 million people, sure. Obviously, it creates
right,
a whole different.
It's a different,
different
animal.
So.
You mentioned the CD, mm-hmm. Folks Throwing Rocks in the Country. Mm-hmm. Not that anyone's counting. That has a 2005 date on it.
Yeah.
We're counting.
We've been counting
we're
for
with
about
you.
3 years now, so we have the material. It's just a matter of the time and the... We sort of unofficially said we wanted to have it out by a new one out by Christmas, but the only good thing about the longer it takes, the better it's going to be, because songs that would have been on it 3 years ago have now been weeded out into that, you know, sort of second tier of songs. So, but yeah, we need to just make a commitment and take the kids, you know, to the grandparents for a week or something like that and just sit down and try to do it.
And it's funny, Chase and I fight about this because we have, you know, on our last one, we did it on our own recording software and everything. And so, which is awesome. But I'm like the girl, I'm like, no, we're going somewhere this time. I want to get a producer. I want to do, you know, I want to make it as clean as I can because, you know, there's all these, you know, submitting for radio things and television and, you know, there's all these really neat opportunities. But are, you know, we really need to have a product, I think, this time that goes that way if we want to do more with it, I think, with the music. So, but Chase is also, which I appreciate, is more of the roots, like, let's do it ourselves, homegrown. And I'm like, let's do it ourselves once we can, like, do it for a living. Do it ourselves. So it's an interesting battle we have going on. So we'll see.
Plus, it's slightly less expensive.
This is true.
Slightly, yes.
A lot slightly, huh?
You mentioned the new material. Is anything as good as that first song on the last one?
I mean,
because that is just an amazing song. I know I've told you that before, but it's just, it's a great song.
It's a good tune. I don't know.
You know, we've got a few that we're actually working on right now that aren't done that I think have a lot of potential to be really great. And
I think Goodbye America might give Don't Ask Why a run for its money.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, and I like Don't Ask Why. My favorite song is...
No, I Thought Forever.
I Thought Forever, yeah.
Oh.
He's talking about I Thought Forever. I knew it.
Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of one of those songs. I think we kind of co-wrote that a little bit.
Right,
because it's
did.
Kind of like... Won't You Stay, where it's just kind of like, you know, rocking and free-flowing, and it's not necessarily a story. So typically when we write on our own, it tends to be, like, more specific and, like, story-oriented, especially for me anyway. But then, you know, I Thought Forever. I don't know. It's hard to say if things are – you get so attached to songs, and then when you write a new one, of course, you think it's, like, the greatest thing that you've ever heard. And then after about 6 months, you're like, yeah, that's okay, but it's definitely not, you know.
I can understand that.
Right.
Yeah.
But I Thought Forever stood up to the test of time, I think, over several years now. So
it's a great song.
Thank you.
Well, do you mind playing one more song?
No, absolutely.
Sure.
This is a song called, working title is Tire Swing. It was inspired by our 2-year-old Hollis.
And it is a brand new song.
Mm-hmm. Brand spanking new here. Grass is taller than my 1-year-old. The sky is warmer than California gold. And I love the way I feel with you right now. Right now. I don't know what
Chase and Missy Gibson inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio at KUAF. My colleague Antoinette Grajeda also was part of that interview. You can see Chase Missy tonight for free at Orchards Park in Bentonville, part of the City of Bentonville's 4th of July celebration. They're expected to take the stage at Orchards Park tonight at 7, followed by the Arkansas Winds Community Concert Band at 8:15, and then fireworks at 9:30. It all takes place at Orchards Park tonight in Bentonville. It's free and open to the public. And speaking of free, Chase Missy will perform again tomorrow night at the Music on the Mountain series, the first Tuesday Music on the Mountain series at Mount Sequoia in Fayetteville. That, too, open to the public and free. This is Ozarks at Large. Happy 4th of July and Independence Day. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellens. With me is Becca Bacon-Martin. She's the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
And as we've waited all weekend, Kyle and I both intend to keep the 10 fingers that God gave us.
We are not people who set off fireworks ourselves.
Not willingly. So we're going to tell you where there are fireworks displays that you can go see tonight.
Set off by professionals.
Exactly. Lake Harrison, obviously in Harrison. There's events all day, games, street dance, and then fireworks tonight. There is a Patriots 4th of July parade today in Bella Vista. There's a 4th of July boat parade today at Prairie Creek.
Sounds like fun.
There's a family fun downtown 4th of July until 6 o'clock today at Basin Spring Park in Eureka Springs.
Oh,
nothing
like,
blowing up.
And, of course, correct me if I'm wrong, but Eureka Springs was organized on July 4th. I think this is their...
Is this their birthday?
I think so.
Well, then happy birthday to them. They also do an interesting thing where they have fireworks tonight at Turpentine Creek where you can bring your own and set them off.
Okay.
So you make your own choices. Gentry Freedom Fest is today with fireworks tonight. Old Fashioned 4th of July at Holiday Island, north of Eureka Springs, starts at 2 with games and so forth. Fireworks tonight. Fireworks after the ball game at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale
tonight.
Be a
lot of fun.
And an evening in Orchards Park starting at 7 tonight in Bentonville with music by Chase Missy and the Arkansas Winds and fireworks.
Will be a lot of fun.
A Fourth Fest at First Baptist Church in Centerton with fireworks. The Mayor's 4th of July fireworks extravaganza in Fort Smith.
Right.
Again, the event at Turpentine Creek where you can blow up your own fireworks. We're not going to get into that again. Fireworks tonight at the Fayetteville Country Club. And yes, it's open to the public. And Fire in the Sky tonight at the Siloam Springs Airport.
And if you have dogs, you might just want to stay home and be close to them.
You know, I have no idea what either of the new dogs is going to do. So wish me luck.
All right. Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
This week in This American Life, when one of our producers, Sarah Koenig, started talking to people about natural gas drilling in Pennsylvania, things got intense.
So how many times do we have to plug it? Do we have to plug it in?
You're yelling at me.
I'm yelling at you.
How industry, universities, and politicians all came to agree that natural gas is a game changer for the economy, for our energy problems.
My levels are off the charts here.
I'm sorry.
This week.
This American Life with Ira Glass, Saturday mornings at 6, Sunday mornings at 10 on KUAF 91.3 FM. Garrison Keillor and a July 4th edition of Writer's Almanac just ahead. Some notes about the rest of this week. First, Thursday will take place, Thursday, at Fayetteville Underground, highlighting another month of all new exhibitions. Graduates of the Florence Academy of Art will be featured in the Revolver Studio. Jennifer Libby Fay's exhibition of abstract contemporary textile paintings will be on display in the Vault, and the work of visiting artist Michelle Mall will be on display in the Hive. And the E Street Gallery will feature free-form sculptural vessels created by John Sewell. For more information about First Thursday, you can go to FayettevilleUnderground.com. And openings are still available for two children's summer workshops at Shiloh Museum of Ozark History in Springdale. What a Doll is designed for ages 8 to 12. It will be held Thursday. And then Wimmy Diddles, Flipperdingers, and Graces for ages 8 to 12 will be held Thursday, August 4th. The Shiloh Museum is located at the corner of Johnson and Main in downtown Springdale. For more information, you can call 750-8165. And the Fort Smith Public Library has some free programs and events approaching. Judith Emerson will be featured at the Authors in the Afternoon at the Main Library Friday afternoon from 2 until 4. And the Fort Smith Library offers a Spanish language story time at the Main Library Saturday afternoon at 2:30. For more information on free events taking place at the Fort Smith Library, you can go online to fortsmithlibrary.org. This is Ozarks at Large.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 4th of July, 2011, Independence Day, 1776. On this day, the Continental Congress approved the Declaration of Independence from Great Britain. It actually had been approved and signed on July the 2nd. It was formally adopted on July the 4th. But John Adams always felt that the 2nd of July was the true holiday, and that July 2nd should be celebrated as the great anniversary festival. As he said, pomp and parade, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other. He refused to appear at 4th of July celebrations because to him it just seemed wrong. Philadelphia held the first Independence Day celebration in 1777 with bells and fireworks. And in 1781, Massachusetts named July 4th as an official state holiday. It's the birthday of Nathaniel Hawthorne, 1804, Salem, Massachusetts. He was born Nathaniel Hathorne and added the W later. He was descended from staunch Puritans in Salem, some of them magistrates who'd been known to sentence townsfolk to public whippings for being Quakers. His great-grandfather was one of the judges during the Salem witch trials of 1692. Hawthorne took up the subject of his Puritan ancestors in his book The Scarlet Letter, and also in The Marble Faun and The House of the Seven Gables, about a family, the Pynchons, who had been cursed by one of the condemned Salem witches. It's the birthday of the playwright Neil Simon, born New York City, 1927, the most commercially successful playwright in Broadway history, the only one to have four Broadway productions running at the same time. Started out writing comedy for Sid Caesar's TV show Your Show of Shows on a writing staff that included Carl Reiner, Woody Allen, and Mel Brooks. And it was on this day in 1802, the U.S. Military Academy opened at West Point. Some people opposed it, thinking that elite officer training was a European conceit, but the Academy had the strong support of Alexander Hamilton, and President Thomas Jefferson officially opened it on this day in 1802 as a school for the Army Corps of Engineers. And it was on this day in 1855 Walt Whitman published the first edition of Leaves of Grass. 12 poems published anonymously, Whitman set much of the type himself, paid for its printing. First edition received several glowing anonymous reviews in New York newspapers, most of them written by Walt Whitman himself. And that 1855 edition of Leaves of Grass contained a preface, a prose preface, which was left out of subsequent editions. And that preface is our poem for today. This is what you shall do. Love the earth and sun and the animals. Despise riches. Give alms to everyone that asks. Stand up for the stupid and crazy. Devote your income and labor to others. Hate tyrants. Argue not concerning God. Have patience and indulgence toward the people. take off your hat to nothing known or unknown or to any man or number of men. Go freely with powerful, uneducated persons and with the young and with the mothers of families. Read these leaves in the open air every season of every year of your life. Re-examine all you have been told at school or church or in any book. Dismiss whatever insults your own soul and your very flesh. Shall be a great poem and have the richest fluency, not only in its words, but in the silent lines of its lips and face and between the lashes of your eyes and in every motion and joint of your body. Wrote Walt Whitman in the 1855 edition of Leaves of Grass. That's the Writer's Almanac, produced by Kathy Roach and written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And that's almost all the time we have for this 4th of July edition of Ozarks at Large. Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from Bordino's Restaurant and Wine Bar on Dixon in Fayetteville, offering lunch and dinner menus using seasonal, locally grown produce. The first seating menu is available on Monday evenings and from 5 until 6:30, Tuesday through Saturday. Reservations, drink menus, and more available at bordinos.com. Ozarks at Large is also supported by the Center for Arkansas Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of the region's history and culture. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Liberty, located just south of Mansfield, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 26 years. You can listen online at our website, KUAF.com. Another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow, beginning at noon on KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Please have a safe and happy 4th of July.
Kathy, I'm lost, I said, though I knew she was sleeping. And aching, and I don't know why. Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all